Hey, Brian, do you know anyone that was once a teenage fundamentalist?
Oh, Troy, you know that I was because you and I have a podcast called I Was a Teenage Fundamentalist.
I did know that. But you know what I find myself asking these days?
No, I don't, but I think you're going to tell me.
What about all those things that church gave us definite answers for? What are we supposed to think about all those things now?
Well, funnily enough, that's what we're doing for season 5 of I Was a Teenage Fundamentalist.
Ooh, Brian, I sense the Lord at work here.
He works in mysterious ways. And we are going to unpack these things. We're going to find out what we do think about them now.
So tune in to season 5 of I Was a Teenage Fundamentalist, the official podcast for the Azusa Street Revival.
I'm not quite sure that's true, but it is available wherever you get your podcasts.
Is it time for a mind shift? If you don't know what that means, then join your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, a former evangelical Christian pastor and Bible college teacher of over 20 years, along the journey of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, life, religion, and spirituality.
I'm talking today with Jonathan Davis. We met, I think it was on a Facebook podcast forum, wasn't it, Jonathan? And I resonated right away because you said you were a former pastor, former seminary professor, former sort of ex-evangelical. I thought, I've got to talk to this guy. So welcome, Jonathan, to Mindshift Podcast.
Thank you. I'm so delighted to be here today.
Yeah, so you're coming out of Texas. You're right in the Bible Belt, man. You're like the buckle of the Bible Belt. Wouldn't they consider that? Like,
yeah, that's right. That's right.
There is, you know, Trump red country, MAGA Christians, and all the rest of it.
Gosh, yeah, everywhere I go.
Yeah, you're in a sea of red.
I really am. It's quite crazy. I'm apparently in the most liberal city in Texas, but I don't really. I used to live on the eastern seaboard of the United States near Washington, D.C., and a liberal city in another part of the country would be not even a probability here in Texas. So, you know, it's all relative, I suppose. It's all on a spectrum. So what seems liberal to people here wouldn't be liberal at all.
Not even close.
East or up near Seattle where you used to live.
Yeah, I'm from Seattle originally, kind of the whole West Coast, the very blue sort of coast, isn't it? It's interesting. Yeah, look at the demographics of America. It's like the blue coast really, isn't it? And then the heart of America, the middle America, it tends to be more red, more conservative, the more rural areas. But from what I understand, Texas is a bit of a weird one because you've got pockets of blue, haven't you, in the midst of the red state.
It is. It's all urban areas, though.
Yeah.
And so the urban centers really throughout the country tend to be more in that blue category, and the rural communities almost 100% are in the deep red category.
That's the way it was. I lived in Portland for a long time when I was going to Bible college and seminary, and what we noticed about the state of Oregon, it's a similar kind of a demographic because the Tri-County area around Portland, whereas about 75% of the state's population live, that's pretty blue. But yet the rest of the state is predominantly more conservative, the more rural area. So it seems to be a thing, isn't it, state to state?
Yeah. I think even in the UK where you are, there's probably some similarities there with a divide between rural and urban.
Absolutely.
Demographics in many, many ways. Yeah. In fact, that's part of what my doctoral work was on, was how cultural change is impacting rural faith communities in North America. So that's something that I've thought about quite deeply, actually.
Yeah. In this country, yeah, we've got some weird divides. It's like a north-south divide. And there's a lot of money down in the southern part of the country. And it's like a different world. You go down to London, and it's like a completely different world. I'm up in the northwest of England, North Wales sort of area. So it's different, more working class, a lot of the background, you know, steel mills, coal mines, all that stuff was shut down by Maggie Thatcher, you know, so there's a whole backstory there that I've learned over the years living here. So you got to learn the history, don't you, of the area that you're trying to reach, I guess that would be the way to say it.
Context is everything when it comes to culture.
It's true. Yeah, you've got to understand the context. Well, I don't know if you've been watching the series on Disney Plus. It's the Welcome to Wrexham. I don't know if you've seen that. Where
I haven't. No.
Yeah,
no,
it's really interesting. Yeah, because where I live, it's about 10 minutes from there. I'm just outside of Wrexham in North Wales.
Oh, wow.
And it's where Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds have bought, it's a football club or soccer club to the Americans, but they bought the Wrexham Football Club a few years ago, and it's just completely transformed the whole area. But even really? They've realized, as you watch the show, Rob and Ryan have understood the context of the Wrexham, North Wales area, and they've realized, you know, it's really about the fan base. You've got to understand the people and the things that they've been through. And
yeah,
they've changed their perspectives massively. You know, they thought, well, we'll just come in here, we'll throw some money in, buy some good players, blah, blah, blah. That's not how it works. You know, it just doesn't be a recipe for success. So it is interesting. But now I'm curious to hear about your backstory, because like I said, we resonated right away. You said, okay, here's a guy that's a former pastor, former seminarian. You said at one point before we hit record, you even started a seminary. So what's your backstory? Did you grow up in Christianity? Were you raised from day one in it?
I was steeped in it, man. My father was a Southern Baptist music minister. And so for listeners who are not from the United States, I would imagine some people maybe have heard of Southern Baptist because they're a large, large group. But it's fairly, I know enough now to know that I was raised in a very fundamentalist upbringing. My family of origin was extremely conservative to the point that, and this is not true of everybody that homeschools, but my family homeschooled me because they were afraid of the liberal education that I might get in public school.
Government schools? And,
you know, homeschooling has changed a lot since the 80s and the 90s, and there's people today that homeschool because they want their kids to have liberal values. So I don't paint with too broad of a brush when I talk about homeschooling anymore, but it used to be that almost only, you know, conservative fundamentalist evangelical families were the families doing that when I was a kid. And at least those were the only groups I was ever exposed to. So yeah, I was raised in the church. I went to a conservative university, a Baptist university here in the States, where I met my wife, which was, you know, looking back, the best part about going to that university was that I met my wife. And the worst part about it was that I got steeped in more conservative Christian BS, and I'm paying student loans because of it.
I know. I was still paying student loans. Even after we moved to the UK, I was doing my doctorate over here, and I still had loans from my undergraduate days.
Yeah,
exactly. I was in Portland, so I was paying years and years later, even though I ended up walking away from the faith, I'm still paying. I finally paid it off years ago, but man, it just kind of rankles, doesn't it? Just, oh.
Yeah, I'm still paying for a fundamentalist college education.
Exactly.
That's terrible.
It's irony is just huge, isn't it?
It really is. Out of college, we moved to Virginia to go to seminary at the graduate level. And my wife and I both went to seminary, and she and I both served on staff at separate churches for a number of years, doing youth ministry, children's ministry, and things of that nature. And after about a decade of that, our oldest son was born, and it didn't seem very tenable for us to continue working at two different churches, because trying to have a baby and both be youth ministers during the summer when we had to go to camps and everything, it was just crazy.
Yeah.
And so I began to think about becoming a pastor at that point because the schedule was more normal, frankly. And I had the education to do it. And by that point, I had started my doctorate. And I just had this epiphany one day. I looked around at a youth minister meeting that I was at with other colleagues. And I wasn't only the only person in the room that had a graduate degree. I was the only person in the room pursuing doctoral work. And I said, you know, maybe unless I'm teaching youth ministry at the collegiate level, I think I'm not going to do youth ministry for very much longer. So like, it wasn't long after that, our son was born, I had started my doctorate, I became a pastor of a church, and did that for a solid decade before helping found the seminary in South Texas that I worked at for about 3 years until just a few months ago. So
yeah,
my whole adult life and all of my childhood has been steeped in faith in one way or another. And some people don't like the word deconstruction, and it you know, is it a buzzword? I don't know. It's still one of the most helpful terms for me and how I talk about unpacking all of my inherited beliefs. And so I would say my deconstruction started even when I was still on staff at churches, thinking
same as me
about, do I really believe this? And a lot of the answers that people had, particularly when I was a youth minister, sometimes I would attend a funeral for somebody, and I wasn't presiding over the funeral or speaking at it, but I would just attend. And I would hear the pastor at the funeral say things that I thought, that is altogether unhelpful.
Yeah,
and I'm not sure I believe that, you know? Yeah. I don't know that there is a reason for everything and that this is all a part of God's plan. And I don't buy it. And so my deconstruction really began because I started reading the scripture more and thinking for myself.
I will do it.
And so, you know, there's a lot of people that I know at this point who've kind of gone through the same process. And one of the things that I still love about having been a youth minister and also a pastor, but particularly a youth minister, is there were kids who were deconstructing the faith of their parents, and their parents were not safe people to ask those questions of. Mm-hmm. And the pastor at the church was not a safe person to talk to. But when they found out that they could talk to me and that I wouldn't shoo them away when they ask a tough question about faith, those were really rewarding conversations. And so I still cherish those conversations in a way, and I've kept up with some of those students, and a lot of them aren't involved in church anymore either. Mm-hmm. And it may be because even as their youth minister, I just let them ask
a safe
questions.
Person. Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
You
and
to be
spread
a safe
doubt
person.
And that kind of thing. Yeah.
Well, yeah, as they, a lot of people aren't safe to talk to. The churches, ironically, a lot of times aren't safe places for a variety of reasons. You don't want to raise doubts, questions, concerns. You could be labeled a troublemaker or a Jezebel or something like that. Well, I wanted to focus in on, there was a couple of words you used earlier in the conversation. You mentioned, you said you were raised in a fundamentalist context, and you were talking about homeschooling. I wanted to ask you, going back to that, as an academic now and an ex sort of evangelical, how would you define fundamentalism? Because I'm thinking there might be someone in the audience, some listener who doesn't know what that actually means, theologically, biblically, culturally, whatever. And then I think we need to get into the homeschooling piece just a little bit, because I've done a lot of stuff on R.J. Rushdoony, the origins of the American Christian homeschooling movement, the Dominion theology piece. I want to find out if your experiences sort of dovetail at all with that. But let's go back to the fundamentalist piece. How would you define that?
Boy, that's a great question. Maybe a loaded one, too. Not that you meant to have it as a loaded question.
Yeah, I'm saying, Jonathan.
Some people, it may be a loaded question.
Oh, yeah.
Or at least not without controversy. I think I would define fundamentalism as, are you familiar with the work of Nancy Murphy?
No,
she's
I'm not.
She's a philosophy of religion person, and she's written a lot about postmodernity. And the way that I understand fundamentalism isn't even around particular beliefs like substitutionary atonement, or that Jesus really was born of a virgin, or like that's
Moses
that's
wrote part the Pentateuch.
That's part of it. But the real, and I think about things from like 20,000 feet. Okay, so I take a high level view of this when I'm answering the question, how do I define fundamentalism? I would say fundamentalism at its core is based on what Nancy Murphy calls foundationalism, meaning that it's the idea that all knowledge and all truth can be traced back to a foundation of some kind that can never be questioned and can never be shaken.
Right.
And which goes back to the Augustinian idea of the divine being the immovable mover, that everything has this divine purpose and that God has ordered the world in a certain way. And for a fundamentalist Christian, that might mean the world was created in seven actual days, and that everything in the Old Testament is literal, like the parting of the Red Sea and Jonah and the whale and
Noah's Ark, all of it. Yeah.
And just go on and on and on about all this. And so it takes a very literal view, fundamentalism, of a sacred text. And so anything that is to the scientific mind, preposterous, right? Never
put it bluntly,
as a miracle, or as an act of God, or something of that nature. So, all of the plagues in Egypt and you could just go through every book in the Old Testament almost, and there's some fantastic story that mm-hmm. that really, at this point, I would call, and most scholars would call, mythology.
Yeah, yeah, legend, right? Mythology.
It's Hebrew mythology that's borrowed from Babylonian mythology.
Sure, yeah.
It's probably borrowed from Egyptian mythology. And if you look at comparative religion, you can trace that back to some of its roots in the Semitic languages and tribes. But so fundamentalism for me, I don't know if I've still answered the question or not. It has to do with a view of the world and a view of scripture that ultimately there are certain truths that can never be questioned. Because if you shake that foundation, or if the foundation is removed, it's like the image of, you know, three legs of a stool, and if you take one leg off, the whole stool is going to collapse. That's the idea of foundationalism, that there's this structure in place, and these ultimate truths that can never be questioned are, the reason that they can't be questioned is if you start taking pillars out from under the foundation, the whole thing's going to crumble. It's a slippery slope. And so, which is a fear-based kind of thing, actually. So,
sure.
So fundamentalism at its core is about the foundational ideas of the faith, whatever that might be, to whatever sect might say, well, this is our foundation. And another sect might say, well, this is our foundational truth. And those truths can't be questioned. And then after that foundationalism, there comes the need for the group to control
mm-hmm.
whether or not those foundations can be questioned. And when people ask the wrong questions or express their faith in the wrong way or wear the wrong thing or hang out with the wrong group or drink the wrong beverage, then they're bucking the authority figure in the system. And if you do that for too long, you'll be ostracized from the group. And so the way that a fundamentalist group protects itself is by fear, by shame, by guilt, and by othering those who it deems to be outside the norms of the system, which is built on unquestionable truth claims.
Yeah, you're beyond the pale then. Yeah, you're outside the circle, whatever. They get to define the circle, don't they?
Yeah, they get to define
the circle. They draw the circle.
And it seems, at least in the stream of origin from my own upbringing, this group, the Southern Baptists, it seems that that circle keeps getting smaller and smaller and smaller.
Yeah, more exclusive.
And more exclusive, because if one of the things of fundamentalism is it by default is combative and must have an enemy.
Yeah, it's militant.
It's militant. Fundamentalism
it was from the
is militant,
beginning.
It cannot live at peace. And if there is peace, it'll make trouble. Just
yeah, it'll pick a fight with somebody.
It'll pick a fight just because it's the nature of the beast.
Yeah,
and so all of those things together for me make up what I would call fundamentalism, and it's more than just a particular set of beliefs about God or the Bible. It's a way of approaching life. It's a way of approaching the divine or human spirituality, if you want to.
Yeah, call it a worldview, a mentality. See, I came to it from the more, I guess, the historical context. Well, it's interesting you took more of a, like a philosophical approach to it. Mm-hmm. When I was doing my doctoral dissertation, I did it on the book of Ezekiel. I was an Old Testament guy. Mm-hmm. And when I was studying the history of the interpretation of the book of Ezekiel, that's when I came across, you know, you go through that time period where liberal theologians were kind of dissecting the book and taking it apart piece by piece and throwing out large sections of it. And mm-hmm. then sort of around the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, there came a reaction to that in the form of fundamentalism. And like you say, the conservative movement,
yeah.
You see it in biblical studies and theological studies and so forth, where
the pendulum swung against Schleiermacher.
Exactly. Yep, yep.
And that whole bunch. And then people like Barth came out.
Yeah, neo-Orthodox theologians.
Correct.
And, yeah, the pendulum swung to, you know, hard to the right, hard back to the left, hard back to the right. And the fundamentalist movement came along and said, no, we need to nail these things down. The fundamentals, that's what the name really goes
fundamentals
back to.
Of faith, yeah.
Yeah, we need to nail down what are 5, 10, however many you want to pick. Moses, yep. The Pentateuch, and whatever, you know, deity of Christ and the virgin birth, and there's a couple mm-hmm. of other ones in there. And if you don't believe those things, you...
Resurrection, and the return of Christ.
Yeah, the bodily return of Christ, yeah.
Yeah, and the... here's another problem with fundamentalism, in my view, by the way, is if you could reduce the basics of faith down to five things, maybe that would be okay. But the nature of fundamentalism is every belief we espouse becomes an essential belief.
Exactly.
And you know, it's sometimes attributed to Augustine, the idea or the saying that an essential is unity and non-essential is charity and in all things love. Maybe I butchered that, but it's the idea that you know, people of goodwill and good faith are going to agree to disagree on some things of the faith. But the problem with fundamentalism is it makes all beliefs essential. And so if you don't subscribe to every little piece of the doctrine that we hold to be true, then you're out.
Yep, you're gone. Yep, you're a pariah or whatever. Yeah, and it starts at, like you said, when you were talking about the control mechanism, that's when I would plug in the cult psychology, the aspects, like you say, the shunning, the dispensing of existence. You have no longer the right to exist, so therefore we are going to kick you out of the group. We're going to ostracize you. Get you whatever the language is, and that's exactly, you could plug that into Scientology or Jehovah's Witnesses or Mormons or Moonies. Any cultic or high control group does that to quote unquote troublemakers, and fundamentalism therefore is no different on that level, I would say.
It's really not. And there are, I wrote an opinion column about 4 years ago that questioned whether or not Trumpism was a cult.
Yeah, I've come to the same conclusion. I've done episodes on it and done written articles about, I believe it is a political cult of personality centered around Donald Trump, and it meets virtually all the markers. You could plug in Hitler, Stalin, you know, any number, Mussolini, the big dictators, you know, and they fit that playbook, don't they?
They really do. It's to a T.
Yeah, it's not just a couple of things. Yeah, it's like a whole
list of things that sociologists and demographers say. These are the markers of a cult, and you go right down the list, and you're like, well, dang, it meets all of those.
Yeah. Well, and the concerning thing, I mean, I know we're kind of getting into politics, but when the 2024 election comes along, this is the concern. If Trump does get elected, he's dispensed with any sort of democratic language, isn't he? He's now saying, essentially, I'm going to become a dictator. I'm not going to hire the same kind of people I did last time. I'm surrounding myself with yes men and women. These people are going to do what I say, and that's what it is from day one. And so this is way more serious, I think, coming up than the 2016 election, like by a thousandfold.
Oh, I don't disagree with that at all. And I think the thing that's at the root of a lot of that enables the movement there is, and I'm sure you've heard this term, Christian nationalism.
Yes.
And there's this unsavory marriage between the religious right and these political power brokers who basically promise on two key issues, abortion and anything to do with LGBTQ
and
progressive equality, that if you elect us, we'll strip people of their right to marry, we'll ban abortion, we'll do this, we'll do that. And most conservatives and evangelicals will look the other way on almost every other moral issue because those are the only two things that matter.
Mm-hmm.
And they're single or double voter issue kind of things. They only care about that one thing. And it's a very, very, very narrow view. And some of it, you used a word earlier about the homeschool idea, dominionism.
Mm-hmm. Yep, dominion theology.
Some of it stems from the idea of dominionism, or even the older, and it's a purely American idea, manifest destiny. Mm-hmm. Like, it's our destiny to be God's chosen nation and all of this kind of stuff. And politicians on both sides of the aisle have misquoted scripture in their speeches for decades at this point. I think Mitt Romney on the Republican side was one of the last to do it really blatantly, but to call America a city upon a hill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
which,
right back to
Jesus' Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5 and 6. But the city on a hill was supposed to be God's children shining God's light in the world, not
a metaphor,
not a nation state. Yeah.
You could push any metaphor to its breaking point, as they say, you know.
Yeah.
And that's what they've done. They've seized on this one.
Yeah, exactly. So, and Christian nationalism basically presumes that the will of our party is the will of God.
Yep. And he's chosen Trump as God's chaos candidate with a breaker anointing and whatever you want to plug in.
In the second half of this conversation with Jonathan Davis, which returns in just a few minutes, we're going to get into this issue of homeschooling. I want to circle back around, and we get then into, of course, the Dominion theology piece, what's going on in the Christian right. So there's a lot more coming in the second half with Jonathan. Just wanted to mention a couple things. What's coming up here in the next few episodes on Mindship Podcast? We've got Jenny Cohn. We're going to be talking about Project 2025. I don't know if you caught the Patreon-only episode I released just the other day on Project 2025. It's about an hour-long episode. It's an exhaustive, deep dive exposing what is actually going on and who are the players behind it. And if you don't know what Project 2025 is and what's going on there, you owe it to yourself to go into that and find out what is going on with Project 2025. And this is something that Jenny Cohn and I get into in great detail. She spent a lot of time researching this for the Bucks County Beacon. And so we're going to get into Project 2025. And then after that, we need to catch up on some of the episodes I recorded a long time ago. We've got Sarah McCammon, followed by a very good friend of mine, Dean Crosetz. He's been on the show before. We have a catch-up. It's been several years since I talked to Dean. So that's just a really fascinating conversation, just talking about life, especially life without God, as going forward. And then when I get to them, I've got some other episodes. I had a really good conversation with Marissa Hackett, who grew up in a right-wing cult. But before that, we're going to release an episode with some friends I've just met, Carrie Jo and Anna from the Heretical Hippies podcast. And we had a fantastic conversation. In fact, we did a crossover episode. So when that drops, I think early May is when it's coming out, you're going to have to go over to their platform to catch the second half of the crossover episode. And also, Anna and Carrie Jo are going to be my guests for the May Mindshift Zoom call. And that is going to be the 26th of May. So you'll get a chance to meet up with Anna and Carrie Jo of the Heretical Hippies. Now, there's a couple of news items. I said the Mindshift Zoom call, but actually the name of this podcast is changing. So by the time the episode with Jenny Cohn comes out, I think all the pieces will be in place. So be warned, it will no longer be called Mindshift Podcast, but I'm not going to change the channel, the feed on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or any of the other things. So you won't lose your subscriptions. But I've decided there's just too many shows called Mindshift Podcasts out there. There must be dozens of them. There's everything from education podcasts. There's Christian pastors going out there. Other ex-evangelicals like me doing the Mindshift Podcast. I've just decided I've had enough of a generic name. So I'm going to be changing the name. So when the episode, as I say, with Jenny Cohn comes out shortly, look for that name change. Now, we've got another piece of news too. And that is, I've mentioned this before, I'm working with my good friend Tim Sledge, editing my book. We're working through chapter by chapter on the final edits. Hopefully when that is done within a month or two, I'm hoping, as I say, this book will finally be released and I'm going to be doing a standalone episode, just reading the first chapter so you can get an idea of what the book is about. And hopefully you'll want to go out and buy it and read it. And I'm going to be doing some podcasts with some other shows to promote the book. So I'm really looking forward to getting this out there. I'm excited about this. I've had a great time writing it and editing it, even though it's been a lot of hard work, but it is nearly there. It's getting so close. I can almost taste it now. And then one last thing, I mentioned that I released a Patreon-only episode the other day on Project 2025. There's a lot more Patreon-exclusive episodes that I've done that are only available on that site. So if you want access to some of the other work I've done, you can help support this show financially, and that will give you access not only to all the exclusive content that's sitting on Patreon, but you also get added into our closed Mindshift Podcast Facebook group. And then speaking of Mindshift Zoom calls, we've got one coming up on the 28th of April, and that is with returning guest Ren Story. Her episode just came out not too long ago. So here's a chance for you to meet up with Ren. She's an absolutely fascinating woman. This is a chance to spend an hour with a returning guest. So these are all benefits that you get for supporting the show on Patreon. All right, let's get on back into the second half of this conversation with Jonathan Davis. We're going to look at homeschooling, Christian politics, or Christian right, and a whole lot more as we continue this issue of what does it mean to be deconstructing, unpacking your inherited beliefs. Well, you mentioned homeschooling. I was interested to go back on that one because, yeah, I was going to bring up that Dominionist piece because I don't know how old you are, but you must be of that generation. Your homeschooling experience must have been some of the earlier
Well, I'm thinking like early 1980s. Was that kind of the time period you're talking?
I'm 41, so mid-80s until the mid-90s when my parents got
married. Right. And as I've understood the history of it, that was kind of during the time period when homeschooling, or I should say Christian homeschooling, was becoming legal. Because before that, it wasn't legal in most states. And that's where a guy, you know, R.J. Rushdoony, founder of Christian Reconstructionism, he was... You could call him the father of Christian homeschooling because he went around the country arguing in court cases for the rights of parents to homeschool their children. And if he hadn't have done that, Christian homeschooling wouldn't, any homeschooling in general, but Christian specifically, wouldn't look like what it is today. But that's his whole piece was, I'm sure you've studied Rushdoony, but as I understand him, you know, enough Christians will eventually homeschool and Christian day school, whereby we will take dominion. There would just be so many of us. So you must have been part of that. Did you encounter any of that language when you were going through the homeschool system?
I did in certain ways, but the folks at the top of that movement had a very crafty way of making it subtle.
Right. Yeah, that's the key.
And it was subtle in the curriculum that they sold to homeschool families. And it was subtle in the events that and conferences that they would plan. And it was subtle, but it wasn't, you know, like
if you knew where to find it, so
it would be,
you weren't reading
an evangelical, at an evangelical conference, it would be nothing for the speaker on the stage in front of 1,000 teenagers to say, we're going to take the world for Christ. Well, when you think
loaded
about
language.
That language, what are they saying, right? And everybody in the sanctuary or the stadium where somebody utters that sentence, we're going to take the world from Christ, is going to go, yeah, we're going to do that.
A cheer.
But they're teenagers and they don't have any idea what it means. And so it gets deeply embedded in their psyche in some way. And then there's always been a kind of a two-pronged approach to this stuff from the homeschooling perspective. One is to try to influence as many families or parents as possible.
Yep.
To then influence their children. But the other piece of it that, as you well know, has been to acquire political control. And so if we could homeschool enough of those families, then we can begin to elect the kids that came through that
system. Yeah.
Into public.
Into the pipeline. Office. Yeah, it's a pipeline, basically, isn't it?
And so there's this entire, it's not even a cottage industry. It's a major financial billion-dollar
business.
It's big
curriculum and everything. Yeah, the conference
curriculum. It's organizations like the Homeschool Legal Defense Association or the HSLDA.
I was going to bring them up. Yeah, Michael Ferris.
Sorts of organizations that will file really what amount to junk lawsuits, but they try to challenge everywhere they can, and they'll pick a circuit court where they think the judge or the panel of judges will be favorable to their claim, and they'll try to get laws passed so that they can either do things like have Bible teaching in public schools, right? Like some of it's focused on homeschooling, but the same junk is impacting legislation in other ways too. So like when I lived in Virginia, I actually represented 1,400 churches to the state legislature on issues that involved religious liberty. And there was a bill that came before the state legislature where the author of the bill or the bill that was presented would have made Old and New Testament classes in every high school in the state of Virginia mandatory, compulsory
classes. Those, as literature, isn't that what they call it? It's like, well, it's just a book. We're not proselytizing anyone.
Right.
Literature.
There's this Pandora's box of questions. Where do you find qualified teachers? And how does a school board determine who's qualified to teach? So I went.
Provide the teachers, Jonathan. We've got a load of them from
seminaries,
Bible colleges.
So I testified in front of the House and the Senate in Virginia, in the state level, and I represented 1,400 Baptist churches in Virginia, and I testified that this was a terrible bill.
Wow.
That this would erode religious liberty, not ensure it, and that, you know, it doesn't even follow the golden rule. Like, because if there were somebody from another faith group that wanted to legislate that their sacred text be taught to your child. You wouldn't want them to do that. So it's not loving your neighbor as yourself.
Yeah, why not the Quran? Why not any other, you know, sacred texts, like you say?
And so it's a, but what my point is, back to the homeschooling piece, the same, what I found out and what we found out, our team, and I was working with Americans United for Separation of Church and State. I was working with the Jewish lobby. I was working with Muslim imams from Virginia to kill this bill, right? Which was is a strange coalition, right? When you
strange
get the Baptists fellows. And the Muslims and the Jews, and United for the Separation of Church and State and the Satanic Temple all testifying against one bill.
Very strange bedfellows.
Strange. But what we all discovered was, of course, the person that brought the bill to the floor, the legislator that brought the bill, didn't write the bill.
Of course.
The same bill with the exact same language appeared in 20 other state legislatures the same year. And we traced it back to one organization. And that organization was one of the organizations that pushes all the homeschool stuff.
Yep. I was going to say, it wasn't Project Blitz, was it?
That was another one.
Yeah, it's a bill.
Yeah, it was Project Blitz. And they're funded by all sorts of other right-wing groups.
Congressional Prayer Caucus. And
Yeah, and there's a lot of big money from, you know, the Koch Foundation and all these like right-wing, far-right groups that are basically just trying to fund, and it's dark money too, because it's hard to trace in these organizations where the money actually comes from, because they're all registered as tax exempt organizations, so they don't have to show their books to anybody.
Shell companies, basically. Funding money.
It's basically what they are.
You've got, like you say, big players, guys like the Greens who own Hobby Lobby, the U-Lines, the Cokes. I mean, there's some major, the DeVos family that own. Or they're the, what are they? What's the cult? I can't remember the name of the Amway. That's right. They own Amway, that's right. They funnel millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions. We don't know how much money into these Christian right organizations. Yeah, I've talked.
And DeVos, you know, your listeners may or may not remember, DeVos was Trump's Secretary of Education.
Yep, she was.
So, you know, it was, that was not unintentional. He was trying to throw the base some red meat.
Absolutely, yeah. That was a campaign promise that he made to somebody, and give enough money and you're going to get this plum position. And ironically, she was trying to basically destroy the whole public school system, you know, school vouchers, charter schools.
Very much so.
Schools, you know, and that's part of that agenda, I think. And that's where Rush Dooney, going back to Rush Dooney, you know, his language was government schools. I don't know if you heard that growing up as a kid. You don't want to send your kid to a government school, a public school. They're trying to destroy that system, or the other option is they're trying to Christianize it, because that's another movement I've seen, is where they'll say, okay, look, we can't destroy this school. We're not here to destroy it, but we're going to Christianize it.
Yeah.
We'll have Christian teachers. We'll have Christian administrators. We'll have a Christian principal. We'll have a Christian school board over that government school, to the point where it will effectively become Christianized. It'll be a Christian school. We're going to sanctify it and take that school for Christ.
Yeah.
Back to your language.
Well, and that's part of the Dominionist plan, isn't it? To take over
The Seven Mountains.
The Seven Mountains, right?
Education.
And one of them is education. And the real fight, or the strategy for these groups now, and you'll seen this the last several years, has come down to just what you said a minute ago, is the school board level.
Yep.
Because school boards are elected. And so the one place, or the easiest place that they can have influence, if you can't pass junk bills in the state legislature, elect loons to be school board members, right? And get people who are of a like mind to serve on that school board. And then they can pass things on a local level. And we'll fund their school board campaigns. If the school board passes a law that's Christianizing the local school, or something like that, then we will, if that school board gets sued by the state or something, or even by the federal government, we'll fund the legal fees for the school board.
Yeah.
You know, because we elected those people to do just that, right? And so they've got this whole system in place where they will guarantee legal backing.
Yeah.
for people to set these policies in place that try to do all that stuff.
Well, yeah, I was just going to say, you mentioned earlier Homeschool Legal Defense Association. I was talking recently with a good friend of mine, Peter Montgomery. He works for the Right Wing Watch, and I have him on a couple times a year. And I'm like, okay, Peter, I need to pick your brains. What's the Christian right doing? And we mentioned Michael Ferris, who, of course, was the co-founder of the HSLDA. I think back in 1983 it was.
That's right.
And he's the guy that became then the president or the CEO, I guess it was, of the ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom, which is the biggest Christian legal powerhouse in America. So they're the ones who wrote the laws for the that ultimately overturned Roe versus Wade, didn't they? But here's a guy. He founded the Patrick Henry College in Virginia, which was a pipeline, as you were saying earlier, for homeschool kids to get a high-quality university degree and also funnel them into the political sector. A lot of them were, the students of Patrick Henry were interns during the Trump era, and even still they are now.
They become legislative aides.
Exactly. So they're funneling them into the political system, and by that means they are taking dominion as they see it, I think, through the political strategies as well as the education piece.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, what's interesting is, you know, that phrase that you used a minute ago, the don't send your kids to a government school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's interesting is conservatives will bash government when it makes a good boogeyman.
Mm-hmm.
But conservatives love government because military spending never gets cut.
That's right. I was going to say.
I mean, there's plenty about government that conservatives love. They love to use government to pass laws that bludgeon other people, right? They don't have any problem with tax dollars being used to implement shady backroom deals that are made with these far-right organizations. They're happy to use government as long as it serves their purpose, right? Mm-hmm. But if it doesn't ensure that everybody's going to get a good fundamentalist education, then government's all of a sudden a boogeyman, and schools are terrible, and you know, the IRS is inefficient, and you know, like
it's just on and on. Well, that was Rush Duty's whole thing, wasn't it? I don't know if you came across that, but the concept of statism, you know, and his argument was essentially that the state has replaced God, God's rightful place as the ruler of the state of the land. And we need to be reversing that. We need to reversing it. That's why it's a government school, because the religion of the government school is secular humanism. Teachers are high priests in this religion. And he just went on a tear. And that you still hear that language. You know, you're sending your kids to a government school. You're sacrificing your children to Moloch. And, you know, that language still resonates. And that's Rush Dooney. You can trace that right back to the early stuff. He was very anti-public schools, you know.
But like the same people are the ones that want the words "In God We Trust" hanging in a prominent location in the office of the school, like
the Ten Commandments on the courthouse and on
it's like
police cars. And
at some point, you can't have it both ways, right? Either the government is this wicked thing to you, and it's always secular. They're pulling in two different directions at the same time, right? Like trying to Christianize the government while also saying how terrible it is.
Yeah, you know, because you can't have your cake and eat it too.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very conflicted, isn't it? Yeah, then you get these people up in, like, the American Redoubt, you know, Idaho, Washington State, Oregon, up in that area.
Yeah.
The Doug Wilsons and those people up there, you know, it's a very strange mix, isn't it? Because, like you said, they're anti-government, pro-public school, pro-homeschooling, and all the rest of it, and yet they're kind of founding this whole movement. You know, when it all breaks down, and which it inevitably will, you better have your guns, and you better have your sort of fortress mentality, and you got to move to the Redoubt and get set up now and get off the grid. And, you know, so that's a big movement in not just evangelicalism, but it seems to be big in sort of that context up there, isn't it?
Doomsday prepper kind of crowds. Yeah.
God, guns, and Trump and everything else, you know?
Yeah.
Well, where were you at? Where are you at today? That's my question. Maybe the final question. We're kind of getting ready to wrap it up. I know we're having a really wide-ranging discussion about a lot of things.
Yeah,
we could keep going a long ways, but I'm interested to circle back. Where would you say you're at now in terms of your sort of belief system? You said you were, I guess, an ex-evangelical. How would you describe yourself?
That's a good question. I think I'm still in the discovery phase.
Mm-hmm.
To be completely honest, I think, not to give a cop-out answer or anything, but I'm definitely not an evangelical. I wouldn't say that I've left the Christian faith, but there's things about Christianity that do not resonate with me anymore. Like, some of those, quote, fundamental beliefs, right?
Like jettisoned a lot of that, yeah.
A virgin birth or bodily resurrection or even substitutionary atonement, that Christ died for my sins, and you know, that kind of thing. I totally and fully reject, like, masculine language about God, or like totally patriarchal language about patriarchal kind of stuff. And me and my family are part of a faith community here in the area where we live, and it's a very, very progressive faith community that I would say has some Baptist-ish roots.
Leaning still.
We to give you an idea of what I mean by that, we have deacons in our church, but last year one of the people that was elected as a deacon is an agnostic.
Might be a church I could be a part of.
Yeah. And we regularly have, you know, LGBTQ folks in leadership at our church.
So it's very affirming, inclusive.
Several of our, and to even go a step further, like, several of the pastors in our church will talk openly in their sermons on Sundays, which are live streamed on YouTube.
Right.
And so Facebook.
People could drop in.
Well, like, our community's talking openly about, is monogamy really necessary? And what could non-monogamy look like for people of faith? And some of those kind of things. And one of our pastors regularly speaks about how she has found a lot of joy and even healing in her own faith because of the kink community that she's become a part of. And I mean, so, like, this is not a typical church.
Yeah, it's pretty far cry from the old fundamentalist background.
Very much.
Never hear that in a fundamentalist church.
And so I don't know how to answer your question other than to say perhaps that if I didn't have a faith community like this one, I probably wouldn't be a part of any faith community.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a community where, for the first time in a long time, I'm completely free to unpack anything that I want to unpack personally. And I was, for so many years, preaching on a weekly basis where every time I got behind a pulpit, I had to choose my own words carefully because, A, if I pissed off the wrong people in my church, I could have gotten fired.
Oh, yeah.
But B, I didn't want to violate my own conscience. And so it got harder and harder and harder to stand up and preach with a straight face when I didn't know if I believed half of what I was putting out. And so I'm at a point now where I think I'm more open to exploring just generally human spirituality and whatever that may mean. And so I've been reading some Buddhist writings, and I think that there's something to spirituality that's very positive in the lives of people. And it can be. And it may not be for everybody.
Maybe that's a better way to put it.
It may not be meaningful, and it may not be positive for everybody. I think for my family, it still is. And I think as parents, we want our kids to have some sense of spirituality just for their own groundedness. But past that, I'm not sure what I believe.
Yeah, you're not pushing anything. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's so cool, though. It's very refreshing to hear that. I think it's very liberating, isn't it, to be in that sort of space.
Oh, yeah.
Not, you know, within these strictures and guidelines. And like you talked about with the fundamentalist piece, what a contrast. Everything has an answer. I mean, if you're outside that circle, you're gone. You're going to be kicked out. You're going to be
disfellowshipped. I still have plenty of family caught up in it.
Oh, yeah. I do, too.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I've had to cut some relationships off with some people that are just so toxic, ironically, and they're loving Christian, you know, context. Yeah. They're like the most cruel, nasty people because they see me as this cancerous contagion, you know, that could spread or something, you know.
Yeah, they've got to save you.
A virus, yeah. I'm heading straight for hell and do not, you know, Pasco, do not collect $200, it's straight there. You know, when I die, just put me in a chute in the basement. You know, just
ride
on down to hell.
I think that was the start of my deconstruction, by the way, was questioning hell.
Yeah, that's a lot of people start there, I think. Like, wait, this is a monstrous doctrine. If it's really true, wow, how could a God that purports to be loving and merciful and forgiving and all the rest of it, do this to billions, trillions of people over the millennia. I mean, that's shocking. It's hard to get your head around that.
Yeah. Well, and that's why I actually, I used to have a really conservative person in one of my churches that was always, "Pastor, we don't hear enough sermons on heaven and hell. You need to preach on heaven and hell." And so finally I said, well, to hell with it. I will.
No pun intended.
And so I preached a 10-week sermon series on everything the Bible had to say about heaven and hell.
Oh, boy.
And it was honestly the very first time in my life that I had really studied what the Bible actually has to say. And most of the terrible theology that people have around hell isn't actually in the Bible at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was refreshing. But then that's, you know, most of the approved doctrine in most churches around that is not even biblical. And most people don't realize it, but they don't want to hear it either.
Oh, they don't want to hear it. Yeah, I remember reading Love Wins by Rob Bell years ago.
Yeah.
It was kind of a similar journey that he went on. He was like, okay, wait a minute. Let's just actually study what does the Bible say about hell? And he couldn't find same kind of thing. He's like, where's all this stuff? And then the interesting part was then the reaction by the fundamentalists. So I actually wrote an article where I reviewed the book reviews by the fundamentalists.
Oh, yeah.
That was so vitriolic on their part. They called it heretic and worse. And I thought, my God, the reaction against his book is that says something about the way they're, you know, going about blasting him and consigning him to hell. So yeah,
Isn't it a strong stance to take to say, where would our theology be without eternal conscious torment?
Yeah. Madness. But
that's a strong stance to take.
Yeah, that's pretty strong. There, you're back in the fundamentalist camp. Yeah.
Well, you're right. It was a vitriolic response to Bell. And yeah, they'd rather follow a guy like Mark Driscoll.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Until he fell apart. But even still, they're, you know,
he's got another mega church in Phoenix. He moved and he's doing it all over again.
Yeah. And he's even worse now because it's even more controlling and cult like. He's dispensed with all of the accountability and checks and balances. He's like, okay, right. I see what I did wrong the first time. I'm not doing that again. Kind of like Trump's, you know, potential election. He's like, I'm not going to hire those same people around me that I had to fire. I'm just going to get lackeys and yes men and all the rest of it. And
that's right.
I'm going to run this cult as a cult sort of from day one.
Yeah, that's how he's doing it. For sure.
Exactly. And it says a lot about evangelicalism, I think, with, like you said, the patriarchy, the masculine Christianity, and the dominionist piece. There's a lot of stuff going on in there. Well, I'm going to ask you this one last question. And if people wanted to get a hold of you, where's the best place they can find you in terms of social media?
I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. And I have a website that people can go to, and my social links are on there. So if people go to drjonathandavis.com, you can connect with me all the places I'm at.
That's the best place to find you. Well, listen, Jonathan, it's been great catching up with you. We'll definitely have to do this again. We'll catch up another time. We'll have another chat about what's going on in terms of American politics and religion and all that. We got a lot to touch base on there, I think, too.
I'd love to do it again, Clint. It's been refreshing and just a delightful conversation today.